a business owner was interviewing candidates for the position of division manager. He decided to select the individual who could answer the question, how much is 2 plus 2? The first candidate was an engineer. He pulled out a slide rule and showed that the answer to 2 plus 2 was 4. The second candidate was a lawyer. He stated that in the case of Svensson versus the state of California, 2 plus 2 was shown to be 4. The final candidate was a CPA. When asked what 2 plus 2 equaled, he didn't respond immediately. He looked around at the business owner and the office, got out of his chair, went over to check to make sure that no one was listening at the door. Then he came back and sat down and said, "Did you have some particular number in mind?" Now, there has been an awful lot in the news lately about what's called creative accounting. Several large multinational companies have gone under because someone's accountant was willing to make 2 plus 2 equal something else. But there's also a parable in the Bible about creative accounting. Did you know that? And it's one of the parables that has bothered me most, because when I think of people in the Scripture that I want to be like, this guy is probably the last. But Jesus seems to hint that there's something to be admired about this manager and his creative accounting. So let's take a look there in Luke 16. Luke 16, starting with verse 1. Jesus tells this parable. It says, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master's taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager quickly told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. And the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. All right, who are the characters in this story? Just listen for me. There's a rich man.
His steward.
And the debtors.
And a couple of debtors. Yes, the oil and wheat owing debtors. Welcome, Paul. Good to see you. All right. In what way is the manager described at the beginning? Or maybe I should put it this way. What situation does he find himself in?
Accused of financial irregularity.
Yes, all right. He's accused of, it actually says, the translation I read, of wasting his master's possessions. What other translations do you have?
Wasting his goods.
Anyone else? No other words? Pardon? Throwing it all away? Right? It's the same word that was used of the prodigal son, squandering his inheritance. Right? So this steward is accused of squandering his master's stuff. Right? So he's reported, he's accused of squandering his master's possessions. What happens then? Yep, man calls him in and starts to ask him questions. What else?
He freaks out.
Well, before that,
he tells him, you can't be my steward anymore.
All right, he's told that he's going to be fired, and there was one thing in between. Yes, he's required to give an accounting Right? So, how does the manager handle all this, Ken?
He freaks out.
Well, he actually takes it, I think, fairly calmly. He's concerned about his future, but he just has a little conversation with himself here. He begins to talk to himself. And what does he decide to do?
He doesn't want to beg.
Doesn't want to beg.
And he's
not strong enough to dig. So what is his plan?
Something people like him.
And he's going to buy himself some friends using his master's money. That sounds, again, an awful lot like the prodigal. Ran off and bought himself a bunch of friends for a short time at least. All right? Accused decides to buy some friends by discounting their debts to his master. What is the master's evaluation?
I don't understand that.
So, call him a shrewd man. Almost like a commendation.
Yeah. It actually says in one of the translations I was looking at, was it in this one?
It says, so the master commended,
commended him.
Unjust servant, steward, because he had dealt shrewdly.
Right. Now understand this. He doesn't have any illusions about whether what he did was right or wrong. He clearly says he's an unjust steward. But he commends him for his shrewdness at the very least. When I was reading this, this is the first time I noticed this. And we'll leave this question open because it doesn't say one way or the other. But was he wasting his master's possessions? Do we know?
If he wasn't before, he was after.
Yes, right? But it says at the beginning he was just accused of it. And again, this is just for what it's worth. I'm not sure that it bears out when you look at the whole story. But it occurred to me that maybe he had been honest before. And once he's accused and fired all at the same time, right? There's no, he's accused, you turn in your books, and you're fired. He didn't get a chance to defend himself. He says, well, as long as I'm going to be accused of this, I might as well get some of the benefit out of it. And so he doesn't. Now, we don't know. It may be that he was dishonest from the beginning. But if I was the master in that case, and I'd accused and fired him all at the same time without giving him a chance to explain anything, and I turned around and found out that he cooked the books after I'd done that, I said, well, I guess I get what I deserve. You know, here was an honest guy before, and I, run him out of town on a rail for something on the basis of an accusation, and he turns dishonest. Well, he was more shrewd than I was. It would have been smarter for me to get the whole story. So I don't know. But one way or the other, he recognized this was a sharp guy. And at the very least, he was shrewd, even though he was not honest. What was shrewd about his actions?
What he did.
Yeah. Well, explain to me, what was so slick about that?
Changing it with the customer and they probably had records of it, and he probably changed it there too.
Probably, yeah.
So the master would never know.
Although the master apparently did find out,
yeah.
Perhaps when it was too late to do anything about it.
Yeah.
But he used the means at his disposal, right, while they were still at his disposal, to take care of his future. That was what he did that was smart. I mean, he was going to lose his job anyway, and he needed to take care of his future. So it was shrewd of him to take advantage of the opportunity he still had to plan ahead for the future. All right. To whom is Jesus telling this parable? Did you notice? Yes, to his disciples. Now, it turns out that there are some other people listening if we read on down the line. The Pharisees are still listening in on this conversation. That's not part of today's sermon. But he is trying to communicate something first and foremost to his disciples. With whom does he want them to identify in this story? Now, you must support your answer for this. With whom does he want the disciples to most identify within the story? Who is Jesus saying, be like this?
Probably the manager.
Why do you say that?
Because if they're going to be like masters, they'd be trying to be in Jesus' spot.
Possibly. We need some more scriptural support, though. What clues do we have from the passage who Jesus wants them to identify with? It's just an assumption that Jesus is the master. Unless we have some suggestion in there of who's...
The 14th verse of it says...
14th verse. What does the 14th verse say?
The Pharisees who love money and Kurt Ball is were sneering at the Jesus.
Yes, but who does... What does that tell us about who Jesus wants his disciples to identify with? That's what we're trying to find out here for the moment.
Well, it says that you can't serve two masters.
Yeah, it says all kinds of things. But who does Jesus want his disciples to identify with is the question.
Well, in verse 8 it says, the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. Certainly he wants us to be more like the sons of light. And yet it almost sounds like he's commending the sons of this world.
Yes, it does almost sound that way.
In verse 9? It says, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into an eternal dwelling.
All right, well, who is that like?
That's the lost.
Pardon?
That's the lost.
That's the lost. I'm not sure I understand you.
But if you're making friends with unrighteous mammon, when that's gone, you're still...
He's saying use unrighteous mammon to make friends for yourselves. So it's not make friends with money. It's use money to make friends.
Yeah, but then it says that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. But he's talking about unrighteous mammon, make friends.
Yeah, try this translation on. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it is gone, right, the you fail seems to actually be talking about the money is going to be gone. You are going to be fired someday. Right? So that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Who is that? Who's he using as a picture when he says those words to his disciples? Who's the example of using money to get friends?
The manager.
Yes. So who does Jesus want his disciples to be like?
The manager.
It seems fairly clear that he's saying, just like this man in my story used money to gain friends, preparing for his future, so you too should use worldly wealth to gain friends, preparing for your future. Now, that's why this story makes me so uncomfortable. Because it seems like Jesus is saying, you know those guys at Enron? Be like them. Emulate the dishonest manager. Ken?
Okay. It uses the term that we assume, that we link with money.
Yeah.
But is it talking about more than just that? Is it talking like use your talents, use your friendship, use your influence, use whatever you have?
Could be. It's all the same stuff as we look at it. Ultimately, it goes back to life itself. Because it's the life energy that I have that allows me to earn money or wealth or to be an influence or to make friends. So those things are interchangeable.
But isn't another name for money filthy lucre?
Well, that's where this is.
And so it's easy for me to look at money as like, it's kind of worldly tainted, and versus, my singing and being helpful. And
yeah, those things are holy, but money is unholy.
That's also a false premise, but that's kind of the easy way of linking it.
The fact is, there's so much in the Bible about money because it's your life converted to cash.
Yeah, it's your time.
Yeah. And so the holiness or unholiness of it has a lot more to do with how you handle it than what color it is. All right, well, that got me thinking. If Jesus wants his disciples to identify with the steward in the story, what do the disciples have in common with this man? What do they have in common with the unjust steward? So I'd like you to elbow the person next to you and make yourselves a list. Maybe we'll just do it all together. What do they have in common with this steward? Anybody want to dive in and begin?
Everything.
Everything? Well, I'm sure it's true. Not very specific. What do Jesus' disciples have in common with this steward? We can ask it this way. What do we have in common with this steward? Well, the steward was a debtor? I suppose that's possibly true, but
he called in all the debtors.
Right. But we're not talking about what they have in common with the debtors. We're talking about what the disciples have in common with the steward. 16:11 says, if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? Yeah.
The true riches is the Christ riches.
Well, we aren't there yet to answer all those questions. Just staying back in the parable, what do disciples of Jesus, human beings who are disciples of Jesus, have in common with this steward? What are some things?
Wasting our possessions, whether it be material possessions, whether it be.
Right. You could be a little bit more accurate with that. When you look at the word steward, wasting whose possessions?
Someone else's.
Yeah. Right? All of us also are stewards of someone else's possessions. Even our very life that allows us to earn money and all that is not ours. It was granted to us, and we are stewards of that. Right? So all of Jesus' disciples likewise are stewards. They have a rich master and are responsible for handling at least a portion of his goods. And you highlighted the one other aspect of that. Well, not just that, but you said we also are wasting. Right? Do we also stand accused, at least, of wasting that which our rich master has granted into our keeping? We do. Are the accusations true? Yes. When the reality is, none of us returns to God. As he deserves the honor and glory that is due to him. We're broken and we can't even do that. Because at the core, we're sinners. So we stand accused as the steward did. In fact, we are guilty, as it's likely that the steward was. Anything else that we or disciples of Jesus, human disciples of Jesus, have in common with the steward? Alright. We try hard to take care of it ourselves. That's good.
We're going to be called before the Master.
Well, isn't that interesting? We also all will be called to account sooner or later, will we not? Very interesting.
Some people say hopefully sooner than later.
Some people do say that.
I say when it happens, it happens.
Have you ever had that sort of foreboding feeling that at any moment someone might find out who you really are? Some people that doesn't bother you, but I'm sure that some of you can identify with that feeling that if anybody found out how I'm faking it, I would be out of a job or out of a marriage, or I know that I'm going to get caught sooner or later. I'm just hoping that it's later than sooner.
Waiting for Dad to come home.
Yeah.
Knowing that when he finds out about the report card.
Yeah. That was how this guy lived, probably. Right? If indeed he was guilty, he knew it was going to happen sooner or later, that he was going to be called to account. And he knew that he wasn't going to be able to make the numbers crunch when it happened. All right, so we also will be called to account sooner or later. At what point is that, generally speaking? At the judgment? All right, well, we have some nuanced understandings of judgment. What do you mean when you say at the judgment? Yeah, it's at the same time that we're out of a job, right? When our stewardship is removed from our shoulders, we can no longer make the books match up. There will be no further opportunity at that point. Right? So, likewise, with the unjust steward, we are expecting to be called to account, and at that time to have no further opportunity to straighten things out that have gone crooked. Well, what does Jesus recommend to his followers? And why? We just looked at this statement when we were trying to understand who he wants them to identify with. He says,
make friends with the worldly things that you got, with the people around you. Because when your livelihood's over, then you can move right in with it.
That's right. Make friends for yourselves now while you have the resources with which to do it, because there will come a time when you will not have access to those resources anymore. And at that point, if you did not use well the resources you had while you were living, your further journey will be negatively impacted. Put it that way. Why make friends using the resources you currently have? How is making friends better than making monetary investments?
You just said your stuff's going to fail.
But what else does that imply then?
That the friends won't, but yes. Friends bought with money are what you pay for.
Sometimes. But if you can truly make friends using the resources that you have, not just buy friends, right, which are worth what you paid for, but if you can truly make friends, not that a relationship can be bought, but if you can use the resources that you have to build a true relationship. The resources, the material things will fail, but the friendship can be eternal. The friendship can be eternal. If when you come to the end of your mortal stewardship you have eternal friends, you will have a place to go for eternity. Who are these friends, by the way? Based on the parable.
Debtors.
Other people who owe debts to the master. Yes. So while you have control over some of the master's goods, take the opportunity to reduce the debts of someone else who also owes the master something. Ken?
So that would be like you as a pastor coming to all of us and helping us get to know God better with the idea that sooner or later you're not going to be able to preach anymore and we'll take you in and support you.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like me using all the means available to me to help you look at my master in a better light. To help you experience forgiveness of your debts to God.
But the internal mental disagreement that I have with myself,
yes,
is that I ought to reach out to my brothers and sisters around me with not the unrighteous mammon, but with the joyful truth of God's love, and then be linked from by the love of God, not unrighteous. I guess I'm hung up on the unrighteous mammon, using that as a link instead of the link that is much stronger, which would be the love and good news of God.
And I guess what I'm suggesting is it's all the same thing. I can spend my life energy earning money and then turn around and use that money to express love. It's still the love from the heart. And if I store up my life energy in stuff, it's all going to burn. If I turn that stuff into love, that can go on.
If you hoard it, you die with it.
Yeah.
If you share it,
you'll get it back. Absolutely. That's precisely it. So what does this have to do with dishonesty? Right? Because this guy's a dishonest steward. Let me put it this way. Jesus is simply saying, even if you were solely motivated by self-interest, if that was your only reason for doing it, the sons of this age, right, selfish people, are at least smart enough to think about their future and to use money to plan for it. And he's saying they're smarter than some of the sons of light who don't think to use the resources at their disposal to plan for their future. So even if you were solely motivated by selfishness, it would be smart for you to give your money to missions so that people can be reached for the gospel. Now, the truth is it can't quite work that way, all right? I mean, if you're just selfishly motivated, God will see through that. But that's the point that Jesus is making. Even if you were just doing it for selfish reasons, it would be shrewd of you to use the resources at your disposal to make friends for eternity. Common sense would tell you that you can't keep this life forever. I mean, how many funerals have we talked about just this morning? At least three. Common sense would tell you your life is not going to continue on forever. At some point in time, you're going to be called to account. It would be wise to plan for that day before it comes upon you. Well, how well does Jesus exemplify this practice of making friends for eternity with the resources at his disposal?
I have their treasures in heaven.
Yeah. How well does Jesus live out what he had in mind for his disciples? Give me some examples. Pardon? Yeah. Even late at night and early in the morning, and the crowds were gathered around, and whatever resources he had at his disposal. You know, we teach and preach a message of balance and, you know, live a disciplined life and get your sleep. And you read about Jesus?
They had no place to sleep.
Well, that he was up all night half the time, and, you know, I mean, he was not a quote-unquote temperate sort of person.
He only had 3.5 years of his message.
Boy, he was burning rubber. You know, he was going to, he hit the ground. He knew this life is not going to last that long. Now, isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah.
We know the same thing.
But he knew.
But he knew when.
His time.
Yes.
But short, where we
and,
figure we got.
Yes, and we also figure we don't want to have any more nasty diseases in old age than we can get away with avoiding. You know, but we're planning to live to those years. So I'm not telling you be intemperate, but it's very interesting that Jesus was not terribly temperate in his life. He had a mission and a purpose, and he was going to use the resources at his disposal to make friends for eternity, if it was the last thing he did. And what was the last thing he did?
Stretch out his arms and die.
Yeah, he wasted everything. And that's what his disciples, you're wasting your life. Why would you let them do this to you? I got thinking back again about the parable of the prodigal. I'd like you just to observe this list. A son requests and receives his inheritance. And what is that inheritance? Do you recall?
Money.
No, that's not what it says. It says, and his father divided his... It literally says, bios.
His life.
His life between them. Now, where does money come from?
Life.
Your life energy, you work, you... Yeah, so he requests and receives his inheritance, which is life, from his father. He gathers everything he has and leaves for a far country. He wastes everything he has. On what kind of people?
Money-hungry people.
Possibly. There's only one place in the story where it tells us actually what kind of people.
Radical living.
Yeah, it says he wastes it on, or he spends it on wasteful living. But there's one place in the story where we're told what kind of people.
Prostitutes.
Surmise that, but it doesn't actually say it anywhere in the story. Yeah. He spends his energy being a blessing to the unclean. You know what part of the story I'm referring to? Feeding the pigs. What a waste of your life. I mean, as if wasting his money on prostitutes was not enough. Wasting his life feeding pigs during a famine. You recall when we looked at that. What a dead-end job. He says to himself while he's there, I'm dying here. Did you ever notice that? Because I'm dying here. After which, he gets up and goes to his father. We find when he gets there, his father has been anxiously awaiting his return. And clothes him and honors him with a big celebration. Notice the father's words. Let us eat and celebrate, for this son of mine was what?
Dead.
And has come to life again. Anything striking you about this list?
It's comparing dead, alive, lost, found.
Anything else striking you about this list? The flow of thought.
The negative and then the positive.
That's what Christ is doing today. He welcomes us everybody.
All right, I don't think anyone's seeing it just yet. What is this list a description of?
Dishonesty.
No. Well, potentially. Yeah, I would argue with that.
You mean like us now?
I mean like a son requesting life from his father, taking it with him to a far country, wasting it on prostitutes and sinners and the unclean, dying, coming to life again, going back to his father, being received as a hero.
Jesus.
It's Jesus.
So you see Satan as being the older brother that's throwing a fit, that Christ is partying with his father, the marriage?
He certainly is the father of the spirit found in the Pharisees that said, what a waste. And the message that I'm hearing for me is that God is not ashamed to waste. Any resource he's got a hold of, he's glad to waste it. If there's any way that it might make a friendship with me for eternity. That's why he can uphold the dishonest steward. You know, God is accused in the universe of dishonesty. Because he is gracious to sinners.
That's because that's who he wants to have turn.
Yes.
Is the sinners.
Yes. And God is willing to be accused of dishonesty.
To get them.
It doesn't look right to those that are concerned with justice. But God's bigger concern is relationship. God could exact justice, and for the rest of eternity, he would be missing the relationship that he could have had if he was more concerned about relationship than justice. And God would not want to live with himself if he took that route. This just blew my mind. Jesus has a lot in common with the wasteful son. So that leaves you and I with a couple of options. Either we can join the older brother accusing Jesus of being inappropriate with prostitutes, or we can be among the prostitutes on which he is accused of wasting his life. Where are you today?
Hopefully here.
Too good to have him waste his life on you? Or are you happy to join the ranks of the unclean to receive that kind of love? Just listening on the way to church this morning to the story again of Mary anointing Jesus' feet and how incredibly she was misunderstood, you know, and how horribly uncomfortable. Every time I read that story, I'm just like, get out of here, lady, you know, they're gonna, you know, how could she stand to go into that place in front of all those people and carry out that act of devotion? Just blows my mind. You know, I'm just not there. You know, I'm in church, I'm looking around, what's everybody else doing? You know, it's not okay to raise your hands in this church because nobody else is doing that. You know, not that isn't something really that moves me particularly all the time, but I'm even shocked when you're in a church and there's one person who's willing to raise their hands as part of their their worship experience, and that's meaningful to them, and they don't care what anybody else is doing. I'm looking around, is it okay to do this? God wants to awaken that kind of love in you and I that does not care what anybody else thinks. It just wants to be with Him. Because that's how He feels about you and about me. Any other reflections? Thank you, Norm. What's going on in your heart when you see this picture? If you can put it in words. I'm drawn. Right? Anyone else?
Your heart's lost. Right. Right. He's more sick to do what he has to get you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyone else? The story of Ebenezer Scrooge is what you find in your heart. The person who is hardened against love but then turns and is willing to give and receive. Is that what you mean? That story is a powerful emotional turnaround for a person. Excellent illustration. Anyone else? What's going on in your heart?
I guess awe. That God would put such a value on me. Knowing me.
Yeah.
You know, seeing through me, He still has
that He gave me life.
Yes.
And He's willing to take me as I am.
Yes.
Sinner. Save my friends.
I'm not particularly wanting to cut off any further comments if someone else wanted to say something. It's lovely to be together in church and see this picture of God and be drawn. I guess I'm still trying to figure out, how do I stay there?
Never point. Be able to earn it. It's
and so the question is, how do I stay there? The place where I'm undeservingly grateful.
Well, the heart of Mary instead of the heart of the person.
Yeah. Because I find when I'm there, it's easy to do, like our Sabbath school talked about, what Jesus would do. I'm not trying to exact justice out of all the people around me. But when I get up and leave, then I'm back to self-interest. Again. how do you stay there? And I don't know that I'm looking for, you know, brilliant answers right now, but I want to stay there. There have been a few times that I can remember. One just comes out very clearly. A group of us got together for kind of a weekend retreat when I was at PUC. And at the end of our time, like when we had to leave, this awareness just settled over the group. And all of us together were just united. We didn't have anything brilliant to say. We just quietly all knew together, oh, God loves me so incredibly much. And literally, people said, I don't want to leave. They weren't talking about mentally, emotionally, although that was what it was really about. But they didn't physically want to leave that occasion, that time and place. Because we knew together who we were in God's sight. And we didn't want to go back to life as usual upon leaving that place. Pardon? Now, you're right. But there's still a sense in which we leave worship behind and go back to the daily grind of activities. And it really shouldn't be that way, in some sense. Even then, the daily grind of activities is not the same. But I guess I'm still looking for how to worship while I am in my daily activities. How to be a worshiper all the time and not just in church. Yeah, in some ways it's hard for pastors. Because, you know, I get paid to do this. And it's easy for me to set up that dichotomy in my mind. Well, I'm not on duty, so... You follow what I'm saying? I don't know how better to explain it. I talked about it a little bit a couple of weeks ago. That, you know, when you get paid to be religious, it
takes on the love and the joy. And the...
It can. It doesn't have to. But it can. You know? It becomes like an assignment in school. And you figure, well, I need a B on this sermon. So, you know, and one of my teachers in school said the only way to really enjoy school is to be more than tasked. Not to be doing it for the grade, but to be doing it for the learning. And so I have to keep that, you know, my what I get paid to do religiously has to come out of what I want to do, with just to be with God. But that's a challenge still, all the way around.